How many times have you ever found yourself saying, me and my big mouth? Yeah, it's a common experience. I know I have, and I'll bet you have too. You were angry, and it just came out, and you said something that you wish you hadn't. And you wish you could take back, but, you know, you can't unring the bell, as they say. You were only joking, but you went a little too far. You crossed the line. Feelings were hurt. You know, you wish you hadn't said that, but you and your big mouth. You were only trying to help, but it didn't come out right, or it wasn't received as intended, and you find yourself saying, me and my big mouth. I remember once I launched into an entire career once because I said something. Without going into all the details, it's just got together with a couple of fellas and we were kicking around some ideas and they said, well, do you want to do it? And I said, yeah, let's do it. And it took me 18 months to get out from under that commitment that I had made. Me and my big mouth. And I know you know what I mean. Here's the question when it comes to taming the tongue or controlling the tongue. Does your tongue... Or let me say it the other way around. Do you control your tongue or does your tongue control you? Because it seems like it's always one way or the other. If you remember back in the first chapter of James, in verse 19, he's already told us, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath. Swift to hear, you know, listen first. Slow to speak, you know, speak after you listen, only if you have to. And then, of course, slow to wrath. And we looked at that verse in depth a while back. Faith that works, and that's what we're talking about. That's what James's entire letter is about. He's describing, he's actually, as we said before, this book is full of imperatives. He doesn't suggest. He doesn't teach us what to do so much as he tells us, do it. And what he tells us here is faith that works speaks carefully. And the first 12 verses expand on that idea by addressing these two questions. Why is it important to speak carefully? And how do I do it? So let's start reading here in verse 1 of James 3. My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many things. If anyone doesn't stumble in word, he's a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Look also at ships, although they're so large and are driven by fierce winds, they're turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles? And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of our nature, and it is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no man can tame the tongue. It's an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. With it we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who've been made in the similitude or the image of God. Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can a fig tree, let me try that again. Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus, no spring yields both salt water and flesh. Fresh. Okay. The first question that this passage addresses is, why is it important to speak carefully? And James here gives us three answers. What you say influences others. What you say sets the course for your life. And what you say reveals your heart. Let's back up to that first one. What you say influences others. Notice here right off the bat when he takes off, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. He starts off primarily here talking to, addressing the teachers that might be among them, or teachers in general. And in order to really get what he's saying here, we need to look at it in that context. Now, let me just tell you, as a teacher, this is a verse that scares me to death. You know, a stricter judgment? If anything, I'm looking for that easy way. Not a stricter judgment, but, you know, I can't not do what the Lord has called me to do. I've tried not doing it, and Ron is not a happy camper living in disobedience to the Lord. So, you know, for better or worse, that's what the Lord's called me to do. But he's talking here, teachers, you better be careful about what you say. And if we look back in the time, in the context that James speaks from here, it really opens the door, kind of paints the picture for us here. In these days, teachers were highly regarded. You know, to be a rabbi was to be a highly esteemed member of society. Now, it still ought to be that way, I think. Teachers ought to be given special esteem and special privilege and special thanks. Doesn't work out that way. In fact, last time I looked, your basic garbage collector made more money than a teacher. Now, that's nothing against garbage collectors. If I'm out there lifting garbage cans, I want to get paid. But if we look at that, you know, paycheck as a form of appreciation, in that sense at least, it's a little out of balance because teachers are so important. In those days, you know, the rabbi got, as we've talked about before, the special seat, you know, that the best watermelon in the pile, the best fish at the fish market, reserved for the rabbi. People would wave, oh, it's the rabbi. Look, everybody, you know, get out of his way. Ooh. And he'd kind of walk around like he was somebody, and he enjoyed it, and they enjoyed it, and that's just the kind of way it was. Teachers were lifted up, I guess you could say, in that community. So teachers were highly regarded, and you know, they still are, I guess. I mean, those of us that, you know, that appreciate it, those of us who have our children go through school, or maybe you're still in school going to college or taking some, you know, graduate courses or postgraduate courses, you know, there's a good teacher is just solid gold. There are some teachers that just move you through the system and can rubber stamp you. But there are some that go out of their way to make sure you learn the material they're trying to teach you. As a matter of fact, Howard Hendricks, the fellow that wrote that Living by the Book that has to do with the Bible, inductive Bible study, Hendricks' philosophy is this, because he's a college professor. His philosophy is that if one of my students fails to learn, it's my fault. He never blames the student. If they don't pay attention, it's because I haven't captured their interest. If they don't understand the work, it's because I haven't explained it well enough to them. If they're dragging behind, it's because I haven't given them the special attention they need to get caught up and keep up. A teacher like that is just solid gold. Unfortunately, they're few and far between, or so it seems, but a good teacher, and when you find a teacher like that and you come to recognize the difference between the rubber stamp, you graduate, next, And the people who are really there to make sure you learn what you're there to learn, you appreciate them. Teachers are highly regarded. A teacher also, and you would think this would just be an assumption, is expected to know what they're talking about. You know, it's not always the case. But they are. A teacher is expected to know what they're talking about. That's another reason why what they say is so important. They have to know what they're talking about. Because, you know, don't you just expect that? I mean, whatever you're, even if you're not a professional teacher, you know, hired as a teacher, whatever it is you know how to do, and you're trying to tell someone else how to do it, you know, you ought to know enough to tell somebody, whether it's how to drive a dump truck or how to start a computer or how to, you know, work a filing cabinet or answer the phone or, you know, make toast. You know, you ought to be able to know how to tell somebody how to do it. It's just important that you know what you're talking about. You know that old phrase, and I use it quite often, you can't teach what you don't know. And so one of the reasons James says you teachers better be careful is because, you know, what you say influences others, and you're expected to know what you're talking about. Now, that same thing is true for the believer. Teachers greatly influence the lives of others, whether it's a school teacher, a Sunday school teacher, the driver's ed teacher, the flight instructor teacher, the college instructor, professor, any kind of teacher, you have an incredible influence on others, and so you have to be careful. I'm thinking about, you know, Pastor Bill Ritchie down at Crossroads in Vancouver. You know, most of you know Bill's been on the radio now on, you know, KPDQ at high noon for 20 years that I know of, maybe even longer, and there are a lot of folks who just get their sack lunch and go sit in their car and listen to Pastor Bill every day. I mean, for year after year after year. What you might not realize is that that radio ministry is not only local, it's not only national, it's international. In fact, if you have the right kind of radio, whether it's AM, FM, or shortwave, or satellite, or whatever, you can tune in Bill's teaching almost everywhere you go on the whole planet, you know, if you know how to look. Now, with that kind of coverage, just think how much influence his teaching has. You know, people trust him. People trust a teacher. And if the teacher is, you know, giving false information, bad teaching, and the students just kind of soak it up, you know, man, he could really do a lot of damage. And so James says, you teachers better watch out. You know, I in the process of editing the radio program that, you know, that we do here, sometimes I just want to kick myself. You know, how many times have I told everybody that Moses built the ark? Or that Noah led the people out of Israel, you know? Or how many times during James have I said, Paul says right here. Now, that's not exactly false teaching. That's not exactly heresy or blasphemy. That's just me with my tang all tangled up and I can't get the words right. And, you know, it's a little different. But, man, what, you know, a teacher has an incredible influence on people. And, you know, look at Jesus. He, at roughly the age of, between the ages of 30 and 33, you know, give or take, either way, he walked around that little area of around the Sea of Galilee and up and down Israel, and he taught these, you know, just heavy, incredible, you know, deep, life-changing, world-changing truths that here we are today digging in, still trying to get the bottom of, to the bottom of and make the most of. I mean, talk about a teacher that has influence. You can't have much more influence than that. Now, what's true for teachers, like I said, is also true to a degree for every believer. Here's what I mean. You, just the plain old, I should say us, plain old run-of-the-mill, you know, born again, living for the Lord, on fire, disciple of Jesus Christ, student of the Bible, filled with the Spirit, just a regular, everyday believer, are looked at differently. We're regarded differently. Now, isn't that your experience? I mean, for better or worse, people find out who you are, who you really are, child of God, disciple of Jesus Christ, taking up your cross daily and following him. They regard you differently. Oh, you're one of those. And either that means, you know, yeah, I found a brother or sister, or it means, oh, brother, sister, you know, kind of a thing. But you are regarded differently. You just can't hardly deny that. You can't get away from it. And you're expected to know what you're talking about. Salvation? How does that work? I don't know. Something about a cross and a rock covered a hole? Well, if that's your best answer, then you got a little more studying to do before you can really consider yourself a Christian, because you got to know what you're putting your faith in. Now, I'm sure most of us, you know, are beyond that stage, that level of learning when it comes to the gospel and the things of God. But each of us are expected to know what we're talking about. Now, maybe not every single question, you know. What was Melchizedek's second cousin's uncle's name? Well, we'll never know that till we get to heaven and ask him, because the word doesn't tell us. There are some silly questions we're not going to ever get to the bottom of. But, you know, when it comes to just you and your faith, people expect you to know what you're talking about. There's been so many times, and most of you know, before I was a pastor, I was a full-time musician my whole life, and there was a season there when I was kind of doing both. I was still working as a musician because, you know, there's still bills to pay and you know, kids to feed, but I was also serving in ministry just on a volunteer basis. And I'd be out in some beer joint playing, you know, Smoke on the Water and Take It Easy. And you'd go sit down on the break at some table with some folks, and they'd go, oh, you know, well, you know, gosh, do you guys play full time? Well, no, it's just on the weekend. You know, we're weekend warriors. We can't really make a living playing full time anymore, at least not the way we used to. They go, really? Well, how do you get by? Well, we have, you know, real jobs. We work all week and we play on the weekend. And, so, well, really, what do you do? And I go, okay, here we go. I'm a pastor. I teach the Bible. And then it's like, well, you know, the cigarette pack gets put in the pocket and the beer can gets turned around so I can't see the label. It's like, what do you think? You're who you, you know, don't even go there. And then it's like they get all kind of uptight. Well, gosh darn, that's awfully interesting. And then they kind of catch their breath and they go, you know, I've always wanted to talk to one of you guys. What is the deal with Benny Hinn's hair? And I can't answer that. I don't know. It's a kind of it's a swoosh. I don't know how he does that. But, you know, they folks just look at you differently, and you're expected to know what you talk about, or what you're talking about. And I don't mind people go, well, what is the deal with baptism, or what is the deal with talking in tongues, or what, you know, why, what's the whole point of the cross? I love it when they ask me that, because then I'll just tell the guys, you guys, the band, start without me. I'm busy. I got something to do here. But we are expected, you know, the folks at work, the folks at school, the folks next door, to some degree, again, not everybody's supposed to be an absolute expert, but you're expected to know what you're talking about, right? Paul says that, be able to give a reason for your faith. And what you say does influence others. Just a regular run-of-the-mill believer. You know, what you say. Because, see, what you say, how you live and what you say, that's people's impression of Jesus and his people. You're all they've got. So the way you talk in circumstances, in situations, you know, the things you have to say and how you say them, they influence others in a big way. So that's the first reason. Why is it so important to speak carefully? Because what you say influences others. That's why he wrote this, "Not let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many things." You know, nobody's perfect. If anyone doesn't stumble in word, he's a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. What he's saying here in so many words is, man, if you can get your tongue under control, the rest of it won't be a problem, because this is nearly impossible. Minity tells us it can't be done, but we can try. Anyway, what you say influences others. Now, the second reason it's important to speak carefully is that what you say sets the course for your life. It really does. The words you speak set the course for your life. That's why he talks here in verse 3 about horses and ships. And, you know, indeed we put bits in horses' mouths. A lot of you folks have horses. You understand this from firsthand experience, that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Now, sometimes the horse doesn't understand the rules on this, I must say, but most horses do, trained horses do. When Mary and I were dating, I had a friend in high school whose family owned a stable, a riding stable. And I had this great idea. Everybody knows girls love horses, and so I'm going to fix this up with my buddy Don, and we're going to go out to his dad's stable and get a couple of horses and saddle them up and go for a horse ride. As a matter of fact, it was that chunk of property where Vancouver Mall is now. Back when Fourth Plain was a dirt road, and you'd go out there somewhere between, you know, Vancouver and Orchards before you fell off the end of the earth, was this giant, you know, I don't know how many hundred acres of just forest and stuff and riding trails, and they had, I don't know, 10, 15 horses, and they would actually, besides boarding horses, they would rent some out for riding. So they're supposed to be tamed and trained and good to go. Supposed to be. So we get out there, and Don's got me all set up, and he's got a couple of beauties saddled up, you know, and Mary gets up on her horse, and he's just, he knows what to do and where to go, and this is just going to be great. I, you know, heft myself onto my horse, who immediately begins to buck, like in the rodeo. And I'm hanging on for dear life. I'm hanging on to the saddle horn and squeezing my legs. And Don says, "Kick him." And so I kicked him, and then he really started to buck. And I'm going, "Don, you're not helping, you know," and I'm trying to get him going. And the horse just kind of makes up his mind, and he heads for the barn. And at least he's not bucking anymore. But then he gets over along the wall and tries to scrape me off, you know. So Mary went for a really nice horseback ride that day. And I, you know, got an ice bag and applied it to my posterior. But except for other than exceptions like that, you know what I'm talking about. When a trained horse, that's what he says here, it's a big old horse, these massive animals, and strong, they're just solid muscle, but just a little tug on that bit, and man, they'll go wherever you want them to go. You know, you set the course for the horse with that little tiny bit and bridle in their mouth. Then he says the same thing about a ship, you know. Look at also at ships, although they're so large and are driven by fierce winds, of course he's talking about a sailing ship, they're turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. And we understand how that works too. In fact, if you've got just a little, you know, little fishing boat, probably you just turn the whole engine, you know, and the propeller changes and you drive that boat around the lake. I had the opportunity once a long time ago, 1980, to be a guest of the Navy on a couple of aircraft carriers, the Constellation and the Eisenhower, over the course of a couple of weeks. Man, those things are big. I mean, they look big from the outside, but until you actually get on one, until you actually have to walk from one end to the other and up and down like 10 flights of ladder, they call it in the Navy, you don't know how big they are. On a hangar deck, they open that big hangar door, and you can see the horizon go up and down because you feel like you're standing on solid ground. That ship is just so big, you don't even have a sense of that, you know, sea leg kind of a thing. They're just huge. And then if you've ever seen one in dry dock, you'll remember the propellers are like, what, 3, 4, 5 stories high. They're huge. And then there's the rudder. Now, it's a pretty big rudder on an aircraft carrier, but relative to the size of the whole ship, it's nothing. And it's kind of the same story for an airplane. You know, you look at a 747 and realize that that rudder on the back, it might look kind of big, but in relation to the size of the whole plane, it doesn't take much to turn that thing. That's what he's telling us here. The tongue is not only like that bit in the horse's mouth, but it's like the rudder on a ship. Just a little thing can entirely change the course or set the course for your whole life. Even so, he says in verse 5, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. It's small, but it has a great effect. See how great a forest a little fire kindles? You know, you forget to put out your campfire, or somebody, we are in California, somebody flicks their cigarette out the window, and next thing you know, you got, you know, 10 counties and a couple of movie star homes are on TV. Going up in flames, and they're praying for rain and for the wind to blow the other way. It doesn't take much, is his point here. Even so, in the same way that a horse's bit, the same way that a ship's rudder, the same way that a little spark starts a forest fire, even so, the tongue is a little member. You know, it's relatively small and boasts great things. It does great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. What you say can steer your life in the right direction, like a bit or a rudder, or it can steer your life in the wrong direction. That's just how much power the tongue has. Another reason, third reason it's important to speak carefully is that what you say reveals your heart. Verse 7, for every kind of beast and bird of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind, but no man can tame the tongue. It's an unruly evil full of deadly poison. With it we bless God our Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in his image. From the same mouth come blessing and cursing, and that ought not be the case. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter? Can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? Thus no spring yields both salt and fresh. See, what you say reveals your heart. It reveals something. It reveals everything about you, really. No matter how you might see yourself or, you know, what you might think about yourself, what you say and how you say it reveals who you really are. It's the difference between self-perception and the perception of others. So you might think you're one kind of person, but people might see you entirely differently. And everybody that's ever been in a band, like I've been in lots of them, knows this. See, you can think anything you want about your band. You can think you're the greatest. You can think you're the worst. You can think you're the loudest. You can think you're the quietest. You can think you're the ugliest, or you can think you're the best-looking guys to come across the planet. But that none of that matters. But what does matter is what people see in that little 8x10 glossy photo. See, that's all they get. And their first impression, their only impression, is based on that little thing. That's their perception of you. And because that perception comes first and because it's so strong, the reality doesn't really matter, you know, up to a point. They just get that perception of you. That's why, you know, first impressions are so important. Matthew 12:33-34. Remember the part that says, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks? See, out of who we really are. from the center of our being. No matter how we see ourselves, no matter how we might try to present ourselves, the fact is that what we say reveals who we really are. That's why he says in the King James, it says, out of the abundance of the heart. The NIV uses the word overflow, from the overflow of the heart. That's a word that means that which fills. So whatever your heart is filled with, that's what flows out. That word also has to do with what you delight in. It's kind of another variation of where your treasure is, your heart will be. So your treasure is where you put it. So whatever you delight in, that's what you take into your heart. And then it's what you say that reveals what's in your heart. It flows from the heart. And that is sometimes more revealing than we would like it to be. What you say, revealing who you really are. Several summers ago, Mary and I lived in Vancouver. And it was, you may remember, there was one summer, I don't know if it was 10, 12 years ago, when it was just hotter than it's been for a long time. I mean, it was over 100 for several days in a row. Hot. And it never cooled off. It was like cloudy. So at night, the heat just kind of stayed there. And it was just oppressive and uncomfortable. And after 3 or 4 days, you're about to go crazy. You know, when's it going to cool off? We went over to the department store and bought a $99 air conditioner. It was just about that big, but it was for the bedroom only. So at least maybe we could get some sleep. Nobody told me the thing sounded like a 747 engine when it went off. You plug it in, and so I can't stand it. So Mary goes down in the basement. You know, genius here, never thought of that. Mary grabs her blanket and goes down in the basement to sleep. It's one of that really hot night. I mean, it's just hot. And so I'm up. The air conditioner's in the bedroom roaring away. I'm out on the couch. And I know it was about midnight because the David Letterman show was still on. So, and I hadn't been to sleep. I'm laying on the couch in a pair of gym shorts. And I've got the 20-inch, you know, box fan, Eskimo fan blowing. And I've got the 26-inch cyclone or thing blowing on from this direction. And I've got that little thing from Mary's flower box so I can mist myself. I mean, I'm just trying to cool off, man. That's all I wanted was to cool off. And I'm laying on the couch, and it got down to a, you know, comfortable, you know, 102 or something. And I'm on the couch with all the fans blowing and the air conditioner roaring. And Mary's in the basement. And I'm just, you know, Letterman's on TV, and I'm laying out on the couch. And I'm just kind of starting to drift away. You know what I mean? The eyelids are getting heavy, and I'm just kind of start to let go. And, yeah, and something brushed by my nose. And I thought it was the dog. We had this dog, and you know, it was about yay big, and if he walked by, his tail, you know, would kind of, and so I'm going, get out of here. Get away from me. And then I kind of lay down and just starting to drift off. And then again, would you go lay down? Get out of here. And then I just, you know, 5 minutes, starts to drift off. And I felt it again. And this time I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to kill that dog. And so I sit up and I look around and the dog's not there. But what is there is a bat about that big swooping from the living room to the kitchen doing figure eights. And it was one of those swoops when he brushed by my nose, right? 3 times. Now, I'm thinking I've got a plan. I'm going to roll off the couch into a squat, and I'm going to run into the kitchen. Now, I don't know why the kitchen, but I was going to do it. See, in my mind, I'm Tarzan. I'm athletic. I'm going to roll over perfect like James Bond, and I'm going to run. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. I rolled over and fell. Thump! And I kind of got up and caught myself and started to run, and I kicked Mary's exercise bicycle or whatever it was, and it fell over. Kawam! And I looked at the bat, and for some reason I said, what are you doing in here? Well, Mary's asleep in the basement. She hears, kaboom! Kawam! What are you doing here? She thinks Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are in my living room coming to take us away. And out of the heart, my mouth spoketh to the bat. And I talked about its mother. I told it where I thought it came from and where maybe it ought to go. The heart, or the mouth, I should say, reveals your heart. And that can be a scary thing sometimes. What you say reveals your heart. It really does. It influences others. It sets the course for your life. It reveals your heart. That's why it's so important to speak carefully. The second question is this. How do you speak carefully? And what do I do? How do I make this happen? Well, there are three faith-influenced questions that you can ask yourself. Remember, James told us to be quick to hear and slow to speak. There's that moment when you kind of take a breath, and that's all the time you need, really, to ask these three questions. Number one, is it true? You ever play the rumor game at a party? You know, they give you that little card that has a sentence on it or something. You know, the ice cream is in the freezer. And then you whisper it in the first person, and they whisper it, and they whisper it. And then the last person in line gets up and says it out loud, and it says something about the ice cream has a tweezer, you know. And you go, oh, that's the rumor game, you know. We can't pass the information along correctly, you know, to save our souls. Seems like I was telling somebody this week, my dad used to watch Hee Haw, and he always got a kick out of the girls that sang, we don't go around repeating gossip, so you better listen close the first time. You know, but that's the idea. We can't transmit information from person to person without it getting fouled up. You got to make sure that what you're about to say is true. Here's what I mean. When I pastored the church down in the center, a gal came to me after church one Sunday, and she goes, "You know, Pastor Ron, you got a minute? Can I talk?" Well, yeah, sure. First I'm thinking, "Oh Lord, what did I do now?" It's like, "No, it's not about you." Okay, let's talk. She says, you know, so-and-so, the guy that runs the store, it was a lot like here. You know, it's Drew's Market. Well, the market in La Center was run by a family, and the guy ran it. His wife worked with him. And she said, well, you know, so-and-so, yeah, I know who he is. And she says, well, you know, his wife usually works with him down there. I said, well, yeah, I know that. He goes, well, I haven't seen her for like a couple of weeks. No, that is unusual. She says, well, my friend told me that she was at the store, and she saw her, the wife, out in the car. You know, they just stopped by to do something. And she waited in the car, and she looked like, I don't know, her face was kind of swollen, like, and her eyes were swollen. And she said it looked like she'd been beat up. I think her husband's been hitting her. And I want to call. I want to turn him in. I said, well, you know, if this guy's beating his wife, then by all means, the number's 911. Let me help you dial. Call him right now and tell him. But before you do that, make sure that that really is true. A week goes by, next Sunday, after church. Pastor Ron, you got a minute? Yeah, sure. She goes, I am so glad that I talked to you last week before I called 911 on that guy at the store. I said, really? What happened? She says, well, it turns out his wife has been sick. She's been taking this medication that makes her face and her eyes swell up. He didn't hit her. He never hit her. He never would hit her. He's not that kind of a guy. And I almost really put my foot in it and just started a whole lot of trouble. Before you speak, ask yourself, is it true? Second question, is it necessary? You know, some things are true, but they don't really need to be said. Is it necessary. Okay, I'm playing a gig again, another band story. I'm with Clam Gun at the Sundowner in beautiful downtown Molalla, Oregon. And we're playing along, you know, rolling on a river, just entertaining the folks and having fun as weekend warriors. And there's a lady out in the audience. And she keeps looking up at me. Now, she's not giving me, you know, the look, but I mean, she keeps looking at me, and I'm thinking, she looks familiar. She's looking at me, and then I'm not looking at you. And then, well, yeah, who is that? And I can tell she's thinking the same thing. And so the band takes a break, and before I even get my guitar off, she's right up at the front of the stage, and she says, "Is your name Ron?" I said, "Yeah." "Ron Stevens?" "Yeah." "Did you used to work in downtown Portland in another club?" Yeah, "I've done that a lot." She goes, "And it was Hank Rasko and the Wasted Rangers?" I said, "Ranger number one, right here." And she goes, "Man, you have really packed on the weight." Well, I had put on about 100 pounds. I couldn't argue with her. In my head, I said, "Yeah, and your skin's turned to leather too, lady." But I didn't say it out loud. From the heart, the mind thinketh, I guess is how that works. Now, was it true? You betcha. Was it absolutely necessary? I don't think so. Is it true? Is it necessary? And the third question, is it kind? See, it might be true. It might even be necessary. But if it can't be said kindly, then it's not Christ-like. So it's better just to keep quiet. Remember that old saying, it's better to keep quiet, let the whole world think you a fool, then open your mouth and remove all doubt. It's got to be kind. If it's not kind, it's not Christ-like. See, that's what speaking the truth in love is all about. Now, man, I have seen some church people hide behind speaking the truth in love to say the cruelest things to one another. Is that really what Jesus would do? You know, Peter, I really love you, and that's why I'm led to tell you that is the biggest nose I've ever seen. Not going to happen. It might have been true. Probably wasn't necessary. Definitely not kind. You know, you just can't hide behind that. I've seen some stuff that just, you don't know whether to kick people in the rump or sit them down and, you know, have a good cry with them. You know, Nancy Sue, you've been a part of our church for 6 years now, and we all like you, but you know the way you raise your kids. It's like, well, it might be true. It might need to be said, but certainly there's a kinder way, a restorative way, a helpful way to say those kinds of hard things if and when they even need to be said. See, here's another old saying. Sticks and stones break my bones, but words will never hurt me. That's the biggest lie ever told. Sticks and stones can break my bones, and I'll go to the doctor and get the bones set in a cast, and they'll heal, and X number of months or years later, you won't even know it happened. But words cut all the way to the soul, and the soul is the hardest thing in the world to heal. In fact, a wounded soul, in a lot of cases, won't be healed this side of eternity. Some speculate that was even Paul's thorn in the flesh. It's a speculation. I'm not telling you that that's what it is, but something that you just can't seem to be completely healed of. Now, you can learn to deal with it. You can recognize God's grace. You can be delivered from guilt. You can be delivered from shame. You can receive hope. You know, not just I wish hope, but through faith, you know, the confident expectation. We can have everything we need, like the Lord told Paul, my grace is sufficient for you, even though I'm not going to take that thing away. Grace is sufficient. But a word harshly spoken, even if it's true, even if it needs to be said, if it's not kind, it can do more damage than you can imagine. Is it true? Is it necessary? Is it kind? If it fails any of those tests, don't say it. Now that just leaves one last question. What do I do when I blow it? Not if. What do I do when I blow it, or if I have blown it? You do this. Two things. You remember what Jesus did for you on the cross, taking the consequences for your sin on himself, transferring the consequences of his righteousness onto you, and setting you free from the power of sin to control your life. That's the first thing. You remember what Jesus did for you on the cross. And then, by faith, you rest. You remember, and then you rest. Rest in the Lord's grace, and his Spirit will guide your steps and control your tongue. Amen.